session number 27813, this is Jack Ray, Real 4. Now, what happened from Gibraltar? Where were you sent to? That was just a call.
Yep, it's okay, back to Britain, and for a short time on instructing.
Now, where did you do instruction?
It was actually, once we got used to the fact, we tended to, most chaps that had been in operation, I think we were sort of hyped up, I suppose the best description, saying we didn't particularly want to stop flying in operation, but the powers that be could obviously see the symptoms and we were due for a rest. And so, in my case, I was posted to Harden originally, Harwooden, near Chester in Britain, and the delightful setting there, had set up in a lovely mess, and then all of a sudden they came along and said that you've got to go off on a flying instructor's course. So within a few seconds I was whistled off to this flying instructor's course, which some of the chaps resented and were trying to get themselves back into fighting and used to deliberately play up, but it was actually a very good flight, a good course.
Now, what was so good about it? What were you learning that you didn't really know?
They found out how bad pilots we really were. We'd become very rough in our flying. We were mass-produced pilots, and we didn't really respect a lot of the finer points of the flying. And because in this case, we had to learn the patter, give instruction, not just in flying, but even while we're giving aerobatics. And actually, it did us good. They found out how, as I say, rough handling we really were. It was only we were lucky we were flying an unforgiving Spitfire that tolerated our bad flying.
Not unforgiving, forgiving.
Yes, forgiving.
Now, you mentioned aerobatics, that's perhaps something I should have asked, but what sort of aerobatics were actually used in action? Because from what you said, it's mainly...
Tight turning mainly, yes. Hard G's and tight turning was usually... You didn't do any fancy aerobatics in combat, really.
They used to talk about lick rolls, half rolls.
Oh, you didn't. None of that to carry, except when I struck that Italian, I got caught into it, but normally, no. The Spitfire did have one. Only once can I ever recall using it in operations, but the Spitfire had a strange little trick that was very handy when we were instructing pupils, and they were out to try and beat you at combat. It was more handy for them than it was in true operation. That a Spit had a delightful little trick that when you pulled it into a very, very tight, steep turn and slammed your rudder on, it went into a complete stall and flicked right over the other way and started turning the other way. And of course, that we never taught our pupils that one. We could keep that up our sleeve because those pupils were bursting to try and beat the hell out of you when you had to meet them. And We told them after we'd done it, so for their sake, so they could do it to the next one. But
that was more for training.
Yeah.
All this looping and half rolls, all that.
It was a bit of not in real operation. There was no time for that sort of thing.
A loop would slow you down, surely.
Yes, I can't imagine. I don't ever remember using one of those. No, that would be silly, I think.
And things like the Immelmann turn.
Yeah, no, not in combat.
So, what did you think of the quality of the pupils? I mean, cause sometimes you can be pretty rough yourself, but when you get a pupil,
They were better. See, because when we went through, we were sort of mass-produced, the early ones, and I began to realise by the time I became instructing that these chaps were coming through far better trained than we were. They'd come through from the Canadian... There's no doubt that Empire training scheme was magnificent, and they produced mass-produced pilots of really quite a high standard. But the danger that we had, as a fighter pilot, they were overtrained, is what we felt. We felt that they were too gentle with their flying, too kind, and we tried to sort of break them back into being a little bit more sort of swashbuckling in their flying. That was only our own outlook. I won't say it was an official one.
Now, when you said you weren't on training long, though, were you?
No, long enough. I can't remember the dates now.
You went to... first you moved to Elgin.
I'll have to pull that back. It's see, August, September. Must have been.
Because you were with 57,
yes,
operational 50, training.
Yeah, 57 and 53 OTU, I think it was.
And you went to Oxford. Don't worry about the date. They can look that up in the book. I mean, that's not, it's not the case.
Yeah.
What about, how did you sat then at Elshaft? That was still acting as training.
No, that's in Northumberland. That was actually, it was great flying. Actually, that Northumberland coast is quite a lovely area to fly, you know. I quite enjoyed it once we got there. But we struck it in winter, and oh boy, it was cold. Snow and ice, and of course, being a new drone, there was mud and clay around for a while. But no, I quite enjoyed it there once we got used to it.
Were you training in Spitford, or would you have masters? You know,
the masters were, we initially took our pupils up in, just to test their flying ability, and then we had Spitfires, and of course the pupils flew beside us in other Spitfires.
And any incidents, because sometimes you can get killed by your pupils almost as much as you can by
that's right.
Was there any trouble while you were there?
The only sad time we had was with my particular flight that I was left in charge at one stage. We had a group, and they were all good. They were, as I say, these boys that came through, they were well trained, and some were quite experienced pilots. But they'd start to play clever and dive under bridges and a few other things, and of course we'd try and warn them not to. And unfortunately, one Belgian killed himself when I was left in charge of the flight, and I had the unfortunate thing, of course, of handling the ceremony for it. I didn't enjoy that period at all. But
I mean, you've never done anything like that, or have you?
Oh well, not quite.
It was quite a famous thing.
But it was suicidal in some of them, because you must remember these fellows had only just had a few hours in the aircraft when they tried to do them. You know, that was the worrying part.
You see, with 57 OTU and then 53 OTU,
was the long one I had there. 57 was only a short space of time.
And anything else should you remember about being an instructor, operational person?
Anything I know is that I enjoyed it once we got to Ayrshot, and a chap called Jumbo Gracie, who was also a man who flew with me in Malta, magnificent chap, and Jumbo came in as a wing flying man in charge, and he immediately left it to the discretion of flight commanders as to what bad weather or what good weather we flew in. In other words, we were allowed to really take our pilots up in stinking weather at times, because they were going to have to do it later. In other words, we produced, I think, a much more experienced, safer pilots than just sticking to the routine.
Because experience.
Yes. Yes, Jumbo is a man who sort of recognised you're a better judge than me, and if you figure the boys can handle it, give them a go, you know. And we were thrilled, because we felt we were producing a pilot that was going to survive.
Now the next stage is you go to Biggin Hill, I think.
Yep.
Now, what was happening here? Is this your next?
Well, the most glorious thing going to Biggin Hill was the Spitfire we got. Was now we suddenly jumped to a Spitfire 9B.
Tell me about that. What was so good about it? How much better was it?
It's so incredibly better in all spheres, but the main one was that we had, up till that time, whenever we tried to dive, our petrol was run in a normal carburetor system, and of course it automatically cut the engine. And the 109s, our enemy knew that, so that if they wanted to evade us, all they did was to push the nose forward and dive. But suddenly we got a Spitfire with a highly efficient fuel system, which we could also put our noses down and dive just the same as they could. And we gave the Luftwaffe one hell of a shock for a short space of time when they tried the old tricks of evading us by putting their nose down, and we just put our nose down and followed them. And actually the Spitfire also had, at that time, the 9B, had immense more power. It was rated at a higher altitude. And when you climbed up to 13,500 feet, extra blowers used to jump in, and the power that you used to get was just a thrill. You've got no idea. The performance of the Spit was marvellous.
Now this is the 9B or the 5B?
The 9B.
It's got 5B here. that's a misprint.
Might be. The 9B was the one that it's the first time we had, we were then better than the Focke Wulf 190.
Right, I think, yeah. Now, which squadron were you joining? You were out Biggin Hill, were you?
Yes, New Zealand squadron again, back to 485 squadron.
And had it changed much in the...
Yes, new personnel, quite a lot of them, some I knew well. We had a great wing commander flying, of course, there was Alan Deer.
He
was a well-known ex-Battle of Britain boy and great fellow, Alan. And of course we had Sailor Milan, the South African, as the CO in the station. So we were operating with a French squadron, and it was a wonderful, powerful wing.
Can you give us a bit of an input? Sailor Mahan, what he was like in personnel?
Very quiet. He was a quiet, reserved sort of man.
But he got a reputation.
Yes, he was a very successful Battle of Britain operator. And he was a good commander. He recognised, he ran a good station.
He'd be a group captain?
Yes.
Now, any other particular personnel you remember, or even friends?
I would rate that Alan Deer as the special one. Johnny Checkets was our CO, and he was outstanding as well. Johnny Checkets. Good. Very good. Very successful.
Also, so he'd fly with you?
Yes.
Well, I presume Deer and Mahan would...
Oh, no, Alan Deer, he was operated full team. Yes, he led the wing. He led the Biggin Hill wing. And,
in the air?
Yeah, in the air. Great leader too.
Now, so what was the situation? What was happening?
Well, this is the time, of course, the Americans were starting to come into this now and full force, and there was some huge operations going on, and we were most of the time then looking after American bombers, and the Mustangs had come in as well for the long range, and we were covering the shorter range of the same attacks. In other words, it was getting more ferocious in some ways in the air, and faster.
And do you remember any events, particular combat or?
One pleasurable one, but it wasn't very brilliant of us. It was silly of the Luftwaffe. We couldn't believe it. We suddenly saw a formation of six 109s flying in tight formation. Obviously doing a training exercise of formation, and we were actually part of a cover of a bombing raid with American bombers, and Johnny Checkets spotted these, and he called up to Alan Deer and said that we want to break off and attack these, and Alan Deer said, okay, I'll cover the wing if you want. So we shot off, just the four of us, and we shot the whole lot down. Was quite, they were just informant. It was pitiful, really. We just sort of picked them up just like ducks flying along. They were doing a training, but it was murder, really.
So they were totally unable to deal with experience.
Yes.
Any other memories other than that?
Not in specific, except that I became a prisoner of war from there.
Now, tell us the story of how you were shot down. We are gliding slightly over that this whole period. You tell us how you were shot.
Well, we were on this operation it was a big operation. We were then part of a diversion for a huge raid that was being sent into the middle of Germany. It was one of the biggest raids. I'm just trying to think. The ball bearing factories in deep into Germany. They were sent. One group, and we were a diversion to try and pull some of the Luftwaffe away. And one massive 190s shot past our squadron when we were, our wing, as we were flying along. And Johnny Checkets at the time called out that he was going to dive in on attack. And so the squadron started to wheel towards the 190s, who were just diving in underneath to our starboard at about 2 o'clock. And by that time, I was flying with Johnny Checkets on this particular day, and just swinging underneath to cross over with him. And I looked up to my left at about 10 o'clock, and there was about another 60 190s coming down on us just as we were turning, and Johnny had by that time started the squadron turning. So literally we were trapped. And the next thing, a 190, I could never believe how it's ever happened to this day, suddenly shot right in front of me, attacking towards Johnny Checkers. And I just go open fire on him, just point blank, and he came to pieces in front of me, and I had to fly through the bits of him. It was far too close. And then soon after that, I opened the throttle to follow Johnny Checkers, and suddenly the motor didn't go. And I got an awful shock that somehow, I'm really not dead certain, but I think I must have absorbed some bits of the enemy aircraft and jammed up the oil breathers. We had oil coolers as well then. I don't know that. It might have been just the engine failure, but that's what I suspect.
Do you think that when you flew through this debris, some of it had...
That's what I think had happened. I had no motor, and that was an awful shock. And what's worse, it was started to throw oil all over the canopy and down the side. And so I just shut the motor off, turned the switches off, and had a dead propeller. And then, of course, no more oil came. And this is where I probably made the dumb decision at the time, because I thought, no, hell, I don't like bailing out particularly. And also, if I can force land this thing, I can pick the right place and where there's no railways near, no army camps, and just pick a nice spot and land and go and escape. I had it all nicely worked out. Even had in my mind a wrong address at that time. And I had a few French francs on me, and I thought, this is good. So I optimistically set off, gliding down with a dead propeller. A little bit worried about enemy aircraft, of course. And anyhow, I got about halfway down, and all of a sudden, two 109s decided to attack me. So I was trapped then into having to dive to avoid them, to get up speed. And the moment that I dived, the prop turned over again and threw more oil over my windscreen. So I had to shut the canopy down, and by that time I was blind. And too late to pick the right spot to load, too late to do anything except try and get the damn thing down. I was too low to jump out. And so I literally did tight circles around a green patch that looked all right until the last moment, then leveled off and hoped for the best. And sort of Dame Luck sort of looked after me, and I managed to get it down. But what I'd successfully done then is landed it right beside a main street, right beside a railway line, right beside an army camp. I did everything wrong. And then, of course, when I jumped out, tore the top of the... I had the flying boots, the British flying boots on, and we could rip the tops off, and I had a pair of shoes. So I dashed up to some French there to ask them help, and, of course, my French was so bad that they just refused to even understand it. what little I had, and I couldn't think of the name of a hat. Because everywhere I looked, the Frenchmen all had berets or hats on, and I had a bare head, and I thought, I must get a hat. everything came out from me but the word hat in French. No, not a show. Chapeau never came near it. I had everything else. But so anyhow, so I started to crawl across a turnip patch, is the best thing I could think of, and start towards the haystack.
Were you hurt?
Hmm?
Had you been hurt?
No, I was quite intact. I was cross about the aircraft. I mucked that up too in this panic, because it was smoking and burning when I got out of it. I was in a hell of a hurry, and I thought it was ready to burst into flames. When I looked back, the fires had gone out, and the plane was just sitting there. And I should have taken the length of time to fire a very pistol and try and set the damn thing alight instead of leaving it there intact for them. But I had made that mistake, and I thought, damn it. I'm doing very well here, so I made for the haystack and crawling along this turnip patch, and all of a sudden I looked at about half a dozen pistols pointing at me with young Luftwaffe boys. They were tickle pink because the army was starting to try and surround me, and here these young Luftwaffe boys had caught me. They thought that was a great joke, so they bundled me into the car. And the thing that did strike me, and I'm sitting there feeling damn miserable in the car, and the door opened and they were still puzzling what to do with me. And a German officer came up, clicked his heels, stood at the door and said, "Guten Tag, do you know Auckland?" I looked at him and started, then I realised, because I still had New Zealand on my stand, I said, "Yes, do you?" He said, "Nein, Guten Tag," and walked off. That was my first meeting of the Germans. So But obviously he must have read von Luckner's book, I think, because that's why the word, probably why he suddenly thought of Auckland. And anyhow, the Luftwaffe boys drove around, bought a bottle of cognac, and shared some of that with me before they got rid of me. That was the end of my war.
They treated you reasonably.
Oh, they did. They thought it was a great joke, yeah.
Now, what was the date you shot that? Do you remember it? Well, then look
at August 22nd, 19... Yes, August 22nd, 1943.
And where exactly were you when you crash-landed? I mean, you say it was exactly where you didn't want to be, but do you know what village or town...
No, I've got a map up there in the room that I could probably show you, an estimate of where it is. But I didn't know where I'd crashed down. Funny enough, some French boys since the war have contacted me and drew a plan and figured where I was. But for you,
it was just somewhere.
It was towards the coast and about halfway between Lille and Boulogne, sort of that area.
So what happened there? What happened in, you're with these Luftwaffe chaps there, they're giving you a bit of cognac. Things not looking too swell.
My next meeting with the German was quite interesting because I still had my cigarettes left with me, and of course I was bursting for a smoke. And the Luftwaffe had got rid of me, the Luftwaffe boys, and handed me over to the military. I was into the old Red Cross, at least to the army boys now. So I marched into this room building, and there was about five guards around with their guns drawn. And anyhow, I pulled out a pack of cigarettes, lit one, and this sergeant jumped out of his desk. He was like a jack-in-the-box. He shot across, Rachen verboten. I didn't know what the hell he was saying then, but I learned later. He whipped the cigarette out, stamped it on, and I've often thought since that he would have been a marvellous supporter for anti-smoking, that chap. He went mad about this. And so that was my introduction to becoming a prisoner.
How did they treat you?
Very good, really. Quite good. But
in the army?
Well, I can't complain. I was stuck in a cell for two or three days because they didn't know what to do with me.
Whereabouts?
Near Dieppe, sort of right towards the coast. I had an Alsatian dog outside the door. I had no show of getting anywhere. And three guards around the one cell.
And were you fed?
Fed, yes. And I felt able. Who looked after me as a sergeant. I learned later the reason he was looking after me because he was getting a special leave to go back to his family by escorting me to Germany. So I was a real pet to him. But he wasn't going to let me escape either. Boy, he watched me every move.
Was it just the two of you?
Just me. Oh, on the move, a guard and himself. That's only the two of us went off to Germany. And we were stuck in Paris at the railway station there for quite a long while. But boy, he was jumpy because he was trying to get transport to get me across to another railway station in Paris, and he couldn't get transport. And of course, funny enough, some of the French were coming up quite close and sort of indicating ways for me to run, and I seriously thought about it two or three times, but I think there would have been mayhem because the chap, the guard that was with me, he would have opened his machine gun straight away, and I just hesitated to take the risk of it. There's too many French around. And the actually felt able himself. He was great difficulty trying to get on the phone, but he had the door half open and his own gun ready because they were very nervous of the French at that time. You see. So I saw my last opportunity to get away disappearing plainly.
Now, what about this question of escape? Did you consider that to be a duty? What was your attitude yourself to escape?
I felt it was a duty. Probably not such a duty. I just wanted to escape. You had a desire to escape, really. It was well summed up with this guard, when we were taken in a cattle truck, my first introduction to 47 Homme, 8 Chevaux, and climbed into one of these cattle trucks. And there was a young German soldier, and I shuffled up close to him. He spoke English. First thing I said to him, I said, "Why did you start this war?" And he said, "You declared war on us before we declared war on you." And I thought, hell, he's right too. So I didn't go on with that argument. And so I said, "Why did you start bombing us?" He said, "You started bombing us before we started bombing you." And I said to the bomber boys, "Is he right?" And they said, "Yep, we bombed Dusseldorf before they bombed us." So I thought, hell, I've lost both the arguments. So I gave up after that. I asked him what they did when we got to the prison camp, and he said, "Oh," he said, "you dig tunnels to escape them, we find them. So that was the philosophy I got from the Luftwaffe. And it was quite a pleasant attitude at that stage.
Now, where were you going? Did you know? No,
I hadn't. I hadn't the foggiest idea. I think one of the biggest shocks, until you suddenly become a prisoner, you never even think about it. You know, our buddies that had gone before, I never thought what happened to them. All I knew was, oh, we got a note from Red Cross and they're alive, and I never thought what happened. But we were warned, of course, you know, name, rank, and number, and that's it. And we were taken to Dulag Luft 3, not 3, just Dulag Luft. And Frankfurt. Frankfurt on Main and Frankfurt, yes, Frankfurt area.
And what happened when you got to Dulag Luft?
I was put in a cell on my own. And so, don't forget, I was a smoker at that time. No cigarettes, nothing at all. And I'm sitting there longing for a smoke. And I was left for nearly a week to cool my heels. I'd get pretty fed up. And
In solitary?
In cell. Actually, they're pretty shrewd. They knew that a person like, say, a fighter pilot suddenly at a disadvantage. The bomber crews were coming in droves. I could hear them coming into other cells, you know, but they were in a crew, and they were saying, "You're all right, John, you're all right, Bill," and even when they shut them up, they knew each other. But with my case, I was a loner, and they knew that. And they'd come back and they'd say, "Look, you're silly. When it's for a name, rank, number, do you think we're going to send a special spy out to check on your mother?" You know, this type of attitude. So they started to wear you down, and you're thinking, "It is a bit damn silly, I'm sitting here." And I said, "Look, you can get toothbrush and you'll have a clean." By this time I was feeling dirty and grubby, and of course he produces a cigarette while he's talking to you as well, and this went on for I think it was nearly well over 2 weeks, and so this time I'm getting really browsed off and a bit of slush to eat, and to compound my problem, I discovered that I pulled my belt off and I found the buckle of it would open the window. It had a jammed window. And then I could peep out and look into the grass outside. And while I'm looking, there's a Russian came along and he was working. There was a German guard standing beside him. And he sort of looked up. He said, Mi Ruski. And he threw up an apple to the window, and I managed to grab it and took it in. I thought, this is pretty good. So I had a nice apple to chew at. And the next thing there was a stomping in the boots and feet, and about six guards poured into my cell. And they whipped at the open. They wanted to know how I opened it. They wanted to try and find the instrument. They were getting pretty upset about it. I don't know what happened to the poor Russian, but anyhow, they slammed it, and then they turned on the heat for a while to make it uncomfortable in the room. And I never saw anyone, no interview or anything, for about a week. And then a guard came in. No guard came in. All of a sudden, one came in one day and he said, "Aus." And so I've marched out of camp and I've taken to the room, and suddenly I had other Air Force fellows around me. I talked my head off. First time I'd been able to talk to anybody for quite a while. And anyhow, then we were marched over to the Dulag, where I was given toothbrush, soap, towels, and the lot, and my hands were shaking with excitement. I just didn't know which to do. I was trying to light a cigarette, didn't know whether to go to the shower, didn't know which to do first. All of a sudden, the guards came in, "Aus," they'd made a mistake. I hadn't meant to go at all. So they marched back and shut the door on me again. No cigarettes, no soap, no lot again. And I sat there for a couple of, and I thought, this is clever. They come in right now, and they ask me, and I'll tell them, yes, they're right. Everything they've got to write, and they had me cold at that point, I think, but they never came. So I stewed it over for about another, perhaps a couple of weeks, and they just opened the door and let me go. They took me into the Dulag.
Did they ever formally interrogate
you or not? Or was it just as informal? It was pretty, you know, I'd say it was informal. He had an Irish brogue, this fellow. He was a corporal, very plausible, very smooth, and what is worse, he had his facts dead right, but slightly out of date. He had would have been an uncle of Barbara's. Reg Grant was CO of the squadron at the time, and they had all this, but actually Reg had left the squadron and was in Canada, but they were telling me he was still the squadron. They were about 3 or 4 months long.